It is 8:30, and we have with us once again Ja Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
What happened to the station in Tacoma and Olympia?
That's just at the top of the hour.
Oh, okay. So you don't mention
there.
Them the rest of the time. Okay.
Yeah, we ignore them the rest of the time.
Hi, everyone in Tacoma.
And Olympia.
I'm good.
Very good. Well, hey, you actually did a good segue there for me. Olympia. Speaking of Olympia, you have something you want to share with us about our insurance commissioner that lives down there in Olympia? Or?
Oh, yeah, they do. Interesting. Just kind of an abrupt transition to the week's news. Had an interesting story I've been working on this week. I have a column in Seattle Weekly next week. I've actually been working on it for a couple weeks now. Concerning the boutique insurance policies, which people may mention, remember, were in the news last summer. These are the policies by places like Virginia Mason and MD Squared and Seattle Medical Associates and some clinics like that in town that charge a flat annual fee in order for customers to get access to their physicians, if they will claim that you get extra services for this, whether it's parking or the chance to see your doctor longer or chance to schedule appointments more promptly, whatever it might be. These practices are basically charging in order for access to the doctors, and there's a couple of different kinds of them. One that bills to insurance and is a flat annual fee, and another one that also goes through annual fees, but that does not bill to insurance and it is sort of an add-on for additional services. Well, the annual fees that are involved for access have been questioned in terms of their legality, particularly under Medicare and other payment systems, where they're being billed to insurers for something that customers are already paying for. It's a double billing kind of question. And there was public forums on this last summer, and the insurance commissioner announced it was investigating this, and that they were highly problematic, and blah, blah, blah. And then we didn't hear anything, and nothing's been done. There was a bill in the last legislative session to regulate them that went nowhere. And so I've been doing a little bit of follow-up and trying to figure out what exactly happened to them. What happened to them was this. I was on the phone this week with Beth Barron, who's a deputy insurance commissioner down there and who's been the point person on this for the insurance commissioner's office. And according to her, this is virtually a verbatim quote, very, very powerful people were saying they were going to take us out if we regulated these plans. And we're talking about the State Medical Association. We're talking about the different clinics and the different people associated with the healthcare industry in this state and healthcare lobbyists in this industry. And it really is a pretty disturbing sort of a case history of what has happened to a regulatory system in at the state level and, of course, federally. You can make the same kind of argument with the EPA and a number of these other agencies where there are laws on the books. You know, the laws are there for a reason. The laws are there to protect the consumer interest or protect the environment or whatever it is that they're out there for, but they aren't enforced, and they're not enforced because there's pressure directly put on the regulators by politicians, by figures from the different industries, so that you get situations like this where you have programs, and they're in place now at a dozen different medical providers in Washington State, most of them here in the Puget Sound area in Seattle and outlying areas. You have these programs that are almost certainly illegal under insurance law and under Medicare law and whatnot, but that are continuing apace. As I said, there was legislation in the 2004 session that would have brought them in. That legislation was dropped because of the objections of these different folks. And, you know, maybe there will be legislation in 2005, maybe there won't. But if there is, it almost certainly will be far weaker than what was proposed this past session. And this is a case history. This is what happens when the rights of the consumer are brought up against the rights of business interests.
So what would you recommend to people to do to bolster
I would say call the insurance commissioner's office and say that that these are problematic issues, that because what happened when they held public hearings last year is that the clinics that have these different programs trotted out a bunch of patients saying, "We love our new programs, and you know, this is a wonderful thing," and there was no organized opposition to it. So what they heard, you want to get that? So what they heard was all this positive response, and of course that was part of the pressure, the sort of the AstroTurf fake grassroots pressure that was being put on the regulators to not enforce the law. So, you know, if there is a counterbalance from actual consumers that are out there saying that, you know, I would like to have access to more of my doctors, I would like to be able to spend more than 10 minutes with a doctor at an HMO, but I can't do it, and programs like this are one reason why it becomes so much more difficult, and you have sort of, you know, almost like an airline system where you have your first class passengers, you know, who get all the drinks and the nice meals, and then the rest of us back there getting miniature pretzels and 10 minutes and a prescription from a doctor. You know, you get this dual system of healthcare for people who can afford the very best, and then healthcare for the rest of us,
or which for a lot of us is no healthcare at all.
Death care yeah. for the rest of us.
Exactly, healthcare when you're on the verge of dying. That's mm-hmm. about it.
All right. Well, University of Washington had their own little health related problems.
Yeah, this also was in the news last year, and in fact it's briefly been in the news again this week for the final settlement of the fines from the billing scandal that happened last year. Dr. Richard Wynn, which is a name that may ring a bell with listeners out there. He was the head of neurosurgery at UW. Excuse me. And he was basically taken out for extensive double billing and billing fraud, but taken out in a very lucrative way. His contract was bought out worth I think it was $3.2 million because he couldn't find equivalent a position of equivalent prestige at another major university around the country. He went to work at Columbia instead, I believe. So. So taxpayers paid him $3.2 million to go away, and supposedly these billing practices then came to an end at UW and UW physicians, and then the item that was in the news this week was, well, who's gonna pay the fines that are being levied by the feds for the billing fraud. And as it turns out, the UW physicians is only going to pay about 20% of those fines. The rest of it is going to be picked up by the hospitals themselves and by UW and by other public institutions. Basically, that's you and I that are being made to pay the cost for that crime. Well, it turns out that there's some whistleblowers that are starting to come out in some other internal documents that, and this is something I've been hearing rumors of over at UW for really since it broke last summer, saying that Wynn, while hardly blameless in all of this, was basically a fall guy for a much wider billing scandal. That it really was university, it really was systemic throughout UW Hospital and Harborview. These are allegations; they haven't been proven. But again, it underscores the fact that there is an awful lot of money that is being made in our healthcare system. That is being inserted into the cost of health care between the actual cost of services and the supplies and the drugs and, you know, all the equipment and all the rest of it, and what you and I and our insurance carriers are in the end being charged for all of these services. And it really underscores once again something that, again, Beth Barrett, this woman at the insurance commission, was saying when I talked with her, that ultimately the whole system's on the verge of collapse, that it really needs a federal solution. There's not a whole lot that can be done at the statewide level to to curb the ungainly monster that is our healthcare system, and that in the interim you have even public institutions like UW, which is supposedly a not-for-profit institution, but which is being managed in very much the same way as a lot of these for-profit hospital chains. You know, going out and charging these outrageous prices and double billing carriers and double billing Medicare and triple and quadruple billing in some cases, and that those practices still continue.
Mm. Boy, systemic sure is a concept that seems to be expanding into a lot of realms these days. I mean, we'll get to that later in This Week in Iraq, but...
Yeah.
Well, and finally, surprising news from Chile.
Yes, this is also in the follow-up file, where folks may remember that when last we left Augusto Pinochet, who was the elderly dictator, now 88 years old. He suffered 3 mild strokes in the last 5 years, and his family says he's mildly demented, and he can remember the prisoners he tortured 30 years ago just fine, but he can't remember events from yesterday quite so well anymore. But play those violins. Shed a tear or two for the disgraced ex-dictator. Well,
who isn't, by the way, sharing a cell with Saddam, though he probably should be.
No, he is not. And if he were sharing a cell with Saddam, I'm sure they could trade stories and
tips.
They'd
have a lot to talk about.
They'd have a lot to catch up on. Old times. Maybe they'd had same handlers at the CIA. We'll get to that in a minute too. He went through this whole process of being prosecuted originally by a Spanish judge, and then he was held under house arrest in Britain while pending extradition. Finally was sent back home to Chile, where a Chilean court ruled that he was immune from prosecution because of a deal that he had cut where he was in the Senate. He had been granted immunity for life, and that deal was held up. Well, a Chilean appeals court this week, by a 14-9 vote, reversed that decision, said that Augusto Pinochet, now 88 years old, could stand trial. This is a remarkable victory. This is something that should put dictators the world around, whether or not they're on the CIA's payroll, and let's face it, there aren't many of them that aren't, but should put people who abuse human rights, people who commit war crimes, people who torture their prisoners at notorious prisons on the outskirts of occupied capital cities, on notice that those crimes, and they are war crimes, are punishable, and they're punishable under international law by everything up to and including death. If you were to look at a list of war crimes and a list of what presidents since World War II have done in the United States, you'd have to conclude that pretty much every one of them qualifies. Certainly, while it's hard to conceive of American hierarchy being charged under these things, certainly a lot of other former dictators, former supreme commanders, and whatever other titles that they give themselves, and some current ones, Musharraf in Pakistan, certainly springs to mind as somebody who's vulnerable to this. That they are on notice now that human rights is not just something for do-gooder NGOs anymore. It's something to be taken very seriously under international law, and can and will be prosecuted. And we now have an international court that everyone except the U.S. has now pretty much signed on to that says that these are prosecutable crimes. And having Pinochet held accountable for what he did for 17 years under the wing of the United States in the 70s and 80s is a tremendous victory.
All right. Well, I guess that takes us over to This Week in Iraq.
This week, the Associated Press TV News released video footage of the wedding party that was bombed by U.S. forces. Now, in the video, people are dancing, celebrating, passing around food. Women have their hands henna'd. They're playing with their children, etc. And then hours later, of course, most of those people would be dead. Now, Arab TV, not Western TV, aired the wedding party footage, along with video footage taken of the aftermath of the massacre, showing the dead bodies of several people who were alive and smiling in the earlier video, which should in itself be enough proof to show that the U.S. military did bomb a wedding party. However, U.S. military spokesman responded by saying that bad people can throw parties too, although they didn't explain how the U.S. military came to conclude that 14 children and 11 women were bad people, nor did they explain why it was necessary to slaughter those people instead of detaining them, unless, of course, this is the new policy given that George Bush wants to destroy the Abu Ghraib prison. Now, speaking of prisoner abuse, the lawyer...
Yes, but he will build a new and better control unit prison, something for which Iraqis are presumably supposed to be very grateful.
And something for which the U.S. Congress didn't allocate any funds in the reconstruction budget that they passed.
But why would that be different from everything else we're doing in Iraq? Never mind.
Anyway, so speaking of prisoner abuse, the lawyer of one of the accused underlings in the prison abuse scandal said in a military hearing that he wanted to call a witness who would testify that Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez was present at interrogations in cell block 1A at Abu Ghraib prison, and that he knew all about the torture techniques being used. And this adds further evidence to the notion that Sanchez didn't approve these tortures in writing, but he may have approved them verbally.
And therefore that the soldiers who were being charged with this were acting on orders, that they weren't simply doing this out of their own volition as a few bad apples.
Right, and rumors have leaked from the Pentagon that Sanchez is now up for a cushy promotion. He might get the Southern Command, which covers most of Latin America. In order to take that post, he'd have to have a promotion from a 3-star general to a 4-star general. So let's all have a hand for Sanchez and his efforts at promotion, including using torture techniques.
Hey, we can throw him a party.
Yeah, maybe a wedding party. Anyway, civilian contractors working as interrogators at Abu Ghraib prison and other detention facilities in Iraq may have been hired illegally. This week, it was found that the Army hired contractors from Titan Corp and CACI, civilian contractors, to perform interrogations under a blanket purchase agreement that was overseen by the Department of the Interior.
Department of the Interior?
Yes, indeed. The Department of the Interior, which usually oversees our national parks.
Isn't that like, you know, Smokey Bear? And
yeah, Smokey the Bear hiring
the
civilian
rangers.
Interrogators in Iraq. How did that happen? You know, what the heck is the Department of Interior doing in Iraq, and Iraqi prisons no less? Well, we're not the only ones who are confused. It appears that the Interior Department is a bit confused about this, too, because it seems that the Inspector General is looking, the Interior Department's Inspector General is looking into the legality of this whole setup. It seems that the Interior Department was drafted to provide, quote, information technology services to the U.S. Army. Now, it's not clear whether it was legal or not for the U.S. Army to use those funds in that blanket purchase agreement in order to hire civilian interrogators in Iraqi prisons or not. And my guess is that it probably was not legal and that the whole setup is a little bit suspicious. Now, moving along here, the U.S. and Britain presented a draft resolution to the U.N. Security Council this week asking for endorsement of the June 30th handover of power in Iraq.
By the way, before we get to that, where did you find that? What was the source on that story?
Because I found two stories, for people who might
want to find out more about that.
Well, I don't have the actual articles in front of me. I found one of those stories in the British press, and the other one I think was a wire service article, or perhaps it was New York Times. I don't recall which. But the information is out there if people want to find it. It has to do with CACI International and renewing their contract for the interrogators in Iraq. Buried in that story is information on the Interior Department being in control of that contract and whether or not that's actually legal. So it's not actually the headline of the story, but if you look for information on renewing the contracts for civilian contractors in Iraq, then you might find that within those articles. So it's not something that anybody else said, wait a minute, this is a big story. It's something that I was reading and it just leapt out at me as, oh my God, one of those oh my God moments when I'm reading the news.
You have a lot of those.
I have a lot of those, yeah. And usually I have at least two or three of those each week, and they end up in this week in Iraq. So anyway, we're moving right along here. The U.S. and Britain had presented a draft resolution to the U.N. Security Council to approve their handover plans. Now, the resolution is notable for what it doesn't contain. Some of the things it doesn't contain is it doesn't specify that the Iraqi government will be able to control its own army and police forces. It doesn't give the Iraqi government veto over the operation of U.S. forces, so if U.S. forces want to do another pull another Fallujah or go into the city of Najaf like they did this week and do like air strikes and other kinds of bombing, the Iraqi government wouldn't be able to say, wait a minute, we don't want you to do that.
Yeah, and bear in mind, people need to think about this for a moment when they're considering whether this is an autonomous government or not.
Right.
You know, if the United States government in an analogous situation would not be able to say to a foreign army, we don't want you patrolling the streets of St. Louis or whatever. I mean, that's the level at which we're talking about, at which the Iraqi government will not have control over what is happening on the soil, on the ground, in Iraq. It's remarkable.
Right. It doesn't impose a time limit for the multinational peacekeeping force in Iraq that's supposed to take over after June 30th. It doesn't specify whether the Iraqi government can tell any foreign troops that they have to leave Iraq. Doesn't give them a deadline to leave. It doesn't allow the Iraqi government to tell them to leave. Now, it does do three very scary things that I just want to enumerate. First of all, it allows the appointed interim government, the interim government that will be appointed by the U.S. and the U.N., to spend Iraq's oil proceeds however they see fit. And it allows the unelected interim government to borrow as much money as they like, so it gives them a blank check to run up much more debt for Iraq. And then it does one more really, really scary thing that I know Jav is concerned about, too. It gives legal immunity to U.S. and British troops so that Iraqis can't sue them for, being stripped naked and drug around on a leash, just to cite a random example.
Yeah, it's we're getting back again to the human rights abuses and the idea that this is something that the United States and Britain have claimed for themselves under the occupation, and they were very concerned to be continued after the handover to an autonomous government. Something else that can continue apace, by the way, once the autonomous government kicks in, or semi-autonomous, I guess, or pseudo-autonomous,
it's the interim government, which will then elect another interim government, which will then draft a constitution and lead to elections for a real government.
Ah, that's sort of like what happened here in 2000,
isn't
it,
though? So we're talking about an appointed interim government,
Yes, that sounds about right.
Which makes you wonder, what is the current governing council that they're not a real government,
But they also have the ability to privatize. They also have the ability to sell off resources. Not just to run up credit, run up debt, and to spend money in a blank check, but also to raise money by selling off resources. That's something very, very important that the ideologues and the Bush administration very much want to see happen.
Yes,
and of course, a lot of their buddies will be getting the resources.
And as Bob Woodward points out in his latest book on the Bush administration, the privatization plan for Iraq goes far beyond any kind of privatization undertaken anywhere in the world, including any kind of privatization that would be legal here in the United States.
Yes. Very, very true. We've talked about that on this program many times.
So my last thing for this week in Iraq is who will head the interim government? Now, the UN envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, was looking for some technocrats all this week and last week to head the new interim government. Now, the Bush administration had different ideas of who they wanted to head the interim government, and so did the Iraqi Governing Council, and there was a bit of a fight. Now, you could look at the search of Ahmed Chalabi's offices and attempts to smear him as a way to sort of push him out of the running, and that's how I view it. Now, Lakhdar Brahimi had wanted a man named Hussein Shahristani, a former nuclear scientist under Saddam, before Saddam Hussein decided he didn't trust the guy and he threw him in prison for a while. That was the guy that Lakhdar Brahimi wanted to put in control as the new prime minister. But it seems that he wasn't suitable for the U.S. government or the governing council. And I saw this story, I believe it was in the New York Times, that the governing council was assembled in order to give their yes vote for a candidate that the U.S. government had already put forward, and that was Ayad Alawi, an Iraqi exile who now sits on the governing council. He hasn't lived in Iraq for over 30 years. He just returned this last year. He's a man with deep ties and long ties with both the CIA and the State Department.
And M16 also.
British intelligence, yeah. Yes. And he's also been on the CIA payroll for a very long time. And he has absolutely no constituency within Iraq. In short, he's very representative of the current governing council, which has no credibility with the Iraqi people. And so
he also has no administrative experience.
That's exactly right.
He, of course, he won't be making any of his own decisions anyway. But
that's right. But he will be allowed to spend money and to sell off state-run enterprises, as we were talking about earlier.
So he sounds perfect.
That's right. He's perfect for the U.S.
Yeah, he won't get any of his ideas.
He's not perfect for the Iraqis, he won't stop the insurgency.
No, he won't get any of his own ideas, and he won't. It's very, very scary, because what you have right now, what going on in Washington, is an attitude where skimming off the resources from Iraq and making a quick buck is taking precedence over following a course which would do anything to stem or end the bloodshed.
Right.
Oh, not to mention the best interests of the Iraqi people.
That's right. And then just to wrap up, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the ways the Bush administration has tried this week to drive all of this bad news out of the headlines. One of those ways is that John Ashcroft has come to the rescue yet again. First, he announced a new impending threat of a terrorist attack on U.S. soil. But if you read some of the reports of this new impending threat, it was pretty clear that the FBI had no time, no date, no place, or method of attack that they knew about, that none of the seven suspects, whose photos you probably saw on the nightly news, are known to be living in the U.S., and most of those suspects are wanted simply for questioning, not because they've done anything or have any particular known ties to al-Qaeda, and that the main piece of intelligence that the FBI is relying on is al-Qaeda's warning way back in mid-March that their preparations for an attack in the U.S. were 90% complete. Now, this has been known for 2.5 months,
And publicly known, too.
Yeah, and we get the warning now. That would tell you a little bit about the timing. The Bush administration is not raising the terrorism threat level from yellow, which is in the middle of the little color-coded range, to orange, which would mean that local police departments and other security firms would have to start doing regular patrols of things like ports and so forth. And the Homeland Security Department, this is the most telling sign, the Homeland Security Department officials have said that they haven't seen any change. They haven't seen any change in the stream of intelligence or information about al-Qaeda and their plans for an attack in the U.S. And Homeland Secretary Tom Ridge did not stand up with John Ashcroft and say that there was any new threat. Now, clearly this was all slapped together in order to drive all of the bad news about Iraq out of the headlines. And it was used along with Bush's little speech on Monday, which was full of so many lies that I can't go into detail. It was used to make people fearful about terrorists and to be compliant. And it was part of the whole propaganda stream to make you remember that this is a war on terrorism, not a war to keep George Bush in office and to take everybody's mind off the economy and all those other problems that the Republicans don't want to fix because they're busy plundering the Treasury for their pals and the oil industry and
dipping
and so
into
forth.
Funds in the Interior Department.
Yes, and dipping into funds through the Interior Department for suspicious expenditures in Iraq.
Putting us all in a compliance hold.
That's right.
All right. Well, with that, we are pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people, where do they find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you can find free publications. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And we are starting a new fundraising drive, trying to get some funds together to pay off our printer bill. We've got a goal of, what is it, 5,000 or 6,000,
yep,
Job?
5,000.
If you want to visit us on the web at www.eatthestate.org, in this coming week we should have some more information about that fund drive and how you can donate for us and help us reach our goal. If you have any questions, tips, or comments, you can call us at 206-903-9461.